actual internal operation of the building, the making of the building itself, that are based in physical forces, gravity, wind, the various loads that are applied to a building and how the building resists those loads, or other kinds of technical performance issues. So we talked about various forces in buildings like tension and compression and bending and shear, and we talked about various materials like concrete and stone and brick and wood and steel, and we talked about characteristics of those materials and how they resist or fail to resist various forces, and then how that actually comes together in making a building that is an elegant and clear expression of the forces moving through the building, and the materials are there to resist those forces in an appropriate way. So the Twitter card question was asking you to observe buildings that you might know that they're physical considerations. So, got a lot of great answers. Let me read you a few of them. Someone says the Brooklyn Bridge, with its array of suspension cables, derives that key part of its form from technology. The cables are both structurally sound and visually appealing, and in tension, by the way, and made of steel, of course. Someone else says compressive forces at work can be seen in the vaults of the Kimball Museum in Fort Worth. The long, solid walls holding up the equally long, solid vaults exhibits a close, compressive space, while the light in the center opens it up. Someone else says, I believe that Buckminster Fuller's spherical dome building that we discussed earlier in the semester, that's the Expo building in Montreal, is a great expression of its technology. The geometric shapes come together without excessive materials, and the structure was designed to respond to the changing sunlight. It expresses technology and innovation well. Someone else says, I think they cribbed this a little, I really like the Hobbit houses. It's really expressive of technology that they had, which was earth, leading to a very round home looking like hills. Someone else says, Battle Hall uses thick stone for its walls, the area with strong forces of compression. The ceiling, where bending forces are present, is made of wooden beams. There's a good mix of materials to allow the building to withstand the different forces acting on it. Really good observation, both compression in the walls and bending in the beams. Someone else says, the Eiffel Tower is entirely expressive of its structural technology. The entire complex structure is a framework, never concealing and construing the beautiful combination of girders that taper toward a single iconic point. And someone else says simply, the pyramids in Egypt express compressive technology. That's all about physical considerations that shape the building in terms of structures and materials. Now, the interesting thing about architecture is that you not only have to figure out how does this building work when it's finished, but you also have to figure out how do we freaking get the thing built. And I think that's one thing that most people don't understand about what an architect does. A whole lot of what you do is not just about what's the building going to be like eventually, but a whole lot is about how are we going to make this building. And a very, very important part of learning to be an architect is learning how to make something. And it's fundamental, whether it's making a chair or whether it's making a table or whether it's making a doghouse or whether it's making a cottage or it's making a high-rise building. All of those things have a process of making, and often the character of the architecture has something to do with how it's made. And in particular, if you're pushing the boundary a little bit of how something is made, if you're trying to do something that hasn't been done commonly before, you may have to figure out how are we going to make this, How is it going to be built? And sometimes that's a very conventional thing, and sometimes that's an extremely innovative thing. But the whole building process is very much a part of designing a building. So I'm going to, at the beginning here, just outline what would be a conventional building process. And then I'm going to talk about ways that one might have aspirations that morph or change or alter that building process in various ways. So I'm going to say there are 7 different steps in a conventional building process. And if you watch almost any building under construction, you can watch these 7 steps in action. The very first thing is what we call site work. Just going out there, taking a raw site, maybe it's got some trees on it, maybe it's got some irregular topography. You might have to remove or move trees. You might have to get a bulldozer in there and alter the topography somewhat. Almost any time there's going to be some alteration to the site, some site work that's going to have to be done at the beginning of the building. Now, sometimes that's devastating and it's not done very well, and sometimes that's delicate and surgical and it's done extraordinarily well. But the first step is site work. The second step is foundations. And again, this is something we don't think about a whole lot, but all those forces that we talked about moving through a building last time, eventually they move into the earth. And it is the ground that receives all those forces. So that we have to have a foundation that distributes those loads into the ground. Now that may be drilled piers that go down to bedrock and carry that load all the way down to solid rock down below. It may be what's sometimes called a raft foundation, where you kind of spread all the load out over a very large area, and maybe there's a less capable soil condition that allows you to rest that raft evenly on an area and distribute that load. Sometimes it's point loads with piers, sometimes it's distributed loads with rafts. But the foundation is a very, very important and very initial part of the construction process. You're out there making the interface of the building with the ground. The third step is to build the structural system. This is really what we were talking about last time. Maybe we're building walls, maybe we're building a steel frame, maybe we're building a reinforced concrete frame, maybe we're building a wood frame. All of those are structural systems that we put on top of the foundation. That's the third step. The fourth step is some sort of enclosure or skin. And this is where we, you know, if let's say it's a steel frame building and maybe you see them putting in metal studs and then you see them putting sheathing on the outside of that and then you see them putting waterproofing and you see them putting insulation. All of these are enclosure or skin. And they do 2 things primarily. They are meant for moisture protection to keep the water out, and they're meant for insulation. So you're putting a skin on the bones, and the skin can be made of any range of materials, but basically it's thermal and moisture protection. That's the fourth step. The fifth step is then going inside and making partitions. So these are non-structural walls or ceilings or can be shaped, it can be rectilinear, could be whatever you're doing to enclose rooms and to make inhabitable various spaces within the building. But the fifth step would be partitions. And then the sixth step would be systems. You go back in and weave all the air conditioning ducts and all the wiring and the plumbing and the Wi-Fi spots and everything that we require these days in terms of various infrastructure technologies in, through, around, and in between the walls and the floors and the partitions and all of that, and put the kind of guts, the intestines and the kidneys and the liver and all those things in the building. And then the seventh and final step would then be to put on the finishes. Those may be interior finishes, maybe exterior finishes. and of course a huge variety of possibilities that go into that. Now, I would totally encourage you to find a building sometime that's under construction and really watch it. For almost anybody, it's an interesting process. Making, building things is fun and exciting and interesting. At the moment right now, there are 5 buildings going up in the new medical school. That would be an excellent thing to watch. Right now, so I would say about 9 months ago, they started doing site work. So they had to move some really big mature live oak trees. They had this incredible machine that took root balls out, lifted the thing up, put it on this big kind of balloon. They transported it over and replanted them other places because where the buildings were going to be, there were some trees, and then there was some exterior outdoor space other places. So they relocated those trees and they did various site work. And then maybe about 7 months ago, they came in and they started doing foundations. And now they've got a whole structural system up. And they're beginning just at this point to do enclosure. You can see on the Education Administration Building, there's some concrete block walls that are beginning to create that enclosure. On the research building, there are some metal studs and some sheathing that's going up. So it's right at a step right now where you can see it in the middle. And you can see what's happening. And over the next 8 or 9 months, they'll be completing those buildings because in July, they have to move into the medical school. So you'll be seeing them doing partitioning. They're already beginning to put in air conditioning ducts and some wiring and things like that, plumbing. And then pretty soon, I would say within the next few weeks, you'll start seeing some stone go up on the Education Administration Building. You'll start seeing metal panels go up on the research building. Those are the skin and the finishes of the building. Now, these things, it's not like they do all of one and stop, and then they do all the next step and stop. They're overlapping, and in different construction processes, sometimes one gets a little ahead of the other in a different way. But basically, these 7 steps are part of any construction process. Now, that's, as I said, a conventional construction process. But there also are unconventional ways. And these days, a whole lot of why we innovate in the building construction process is for economy. We're a culture, we're an economy right now in the United States where labor is very expensive. Building buildings requires labor, a lot of labor. And honestly, this is not easily exportable labor. We can't send it to China and get cheap labor to build that building, because it physically is done here in a spot. So we have to be clever about how we use labor. And we're constantly looking for ways to be more economical in terms of the manual labor that's required to build buildings. The pyramids, obviously, thousands and thousands of freaking Jewish slaves they were using to do those for decades. That's a lot of manpower. These days, we don't have that kind of manpower. We build in completely different ways, and we think about building in a different way. Okay, so how might you save labor? A typical suburban house that you might have seen built in your neighborhood, made out of stick frame, the old way of doing that would be for the carpenter to call up the lumber yard and say, okay, I want X number of board feet of 2x4s and X number of board feet of 2x6s and X number of board feet of 2x8s and 2x12s. And they come delivered to the site all in 12-foot lengths. And then the carpenter would get their drawings out and they'd figure out, okay, I got to cut these studs this length and I got to cut those rafters this length. And they'd get their saw out and they'd cut each of those individual pieces and they'd take their hammer and their nails and they'd nail in each of those and they'd assemble the thing. And that's pretty damn labor intensive. These days, hardly any, even the most custom house, is usually not made completely that way. There may be some gang-nailed wooden trusses that they would make in a factory somewhere, and they would deliver to the site. And because they're made in a factory, and you don't have to be out in the hot sun, and because they can be made in a repetitive fashion, And because you don't have to toenail one piece into another piece, instead there's a gun that does a gang nail, which is like a plate of metal with lots of spikes on it. And you just put two pieces of wood together like that, and you just go boom, whoops. And it nails the two pieces together. So there are robotic systems even that make these gang-nailed wooden trusses, and it doesn't require so many people to do it. And then you pre-assemble all these things, and you put them on a truck, and you take them to the site, and you lift them up, and it takes many, many fewer man hours to construct that. That's a simple way of having a more economical, labor-saving building process. There even is a company in Louisiana right now that you can send them the plans for any house. They will pre-cut every single piece in the house and label it and deliver it to the site with all of the pieces all cut and with little tags on them, just like Tinker Toys. And then you just have to read the instructions and assemble according to instructions. So there, somebody else is doing it in a very mechanized way and trying to make it more efficient in terms of labor. Now, those are little baby steps. Also, these days, a lot of times we do precast concrete planks instead of pouring the concrete floor on the site. So they're all done in a factory, and they're brought to the site, and then they're erected up again like an erector set. But maybe one of the most extreme examples of this is a building that was actually done quite a long time ago in San Antonio. So this was an interesting building process. And what provoked it was that in 1968, they were going to have a World's Fair, or actually a half of a World's Fair, in San Antonio. They called it Hemisphere, because it was a World's Fair for the North and South America, for the Western Hemisphere. And so that had been in the plans for a long time, and they had gotten all the countries to plan their pavilions, and they did a master plan of the site, and they did all these preparations for the fair. But then as it got close to opening time, they realized that this is going to be more successful than we thought. We're probably going to have a lot more visitors than we anticipated. And we don't freaking have enough hotel rooms in San Antonio to accommodate all these visitors that want to come here. And it's just like 9 months before the fair opens. And we need a new hotel. We need a big new hotel right down by the fairgrounds. Well, 9 months is not enough time to build a hotel. It would take a year and a half, easy, to build a 18-20-story hotel. So, in a certain way, they just got to say, okay, well, that's not possible. But instead, they said, no, let's figure out a building process so that we can build this hotel much faster. Now the issue is not so much saving labor as it is saving time. So instead of going through the steps I just described, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, instead they said, could we compress some of those things? Could we do them concurrently and completely turn the building process on its head? So what they did was they decided that while they're doing the site work and while they're doing the foundations, they'll also be building the hotel rooms and putting the finishes on. Oh, wait, how's that possible? Well, they set up a factory, and they started building these concrete hotel rooms one by one. And they had this repetitive formwork that they would set up, and they would pour one hotel room, and then they'd move down, reset up the formwork, pour another one, reset up the formwork, pour another one, reset up the formwork, pour another one. All of this done on the ground, not up in the air, and resulting in all of these individual hotel rooms. So what you're seeing there is a hotel room and half of the corridor of the floor above. And here's the hotel room across the hall and half the corridor. And so they'd stack these up, and then they'd pour a connector joint between these two, and that would make two hotel rooms across the corridor from each other. And they actually built the whole damn hotel room. I mean, they put the furniture in and bolted it to the walls and to the floor. They even put pictures on the wall. They put all the glass in. They put all the toilets and the sinks. And they built the whole hotel room just a little bit of plumbing that extended out that would have to be connected to something else, just some wiring that extended out and have to be connected to something else. But the whole hotel room was made complete. And then in the meantime, they were building the elevator shaft for the building with all of the elevators that would give delivery to all those different floors. And they were building each little hotel room separately with a gap in between. In that gap, they would have all the plumbing and the wiring and whatever they needed to service those individual hotel rooms once they got them placed in the right location. So there they are lifting those hotel rooms, stacking them up. Here you see all of them on the other side of that corridor with half the corridor sticking out there. And here they put the ones on the opposite side of the corridor. And then they just seal that joint between. There's a gap between each of those. As you build the floor, you build up the plumbing and connect it to the next floor, and then build it up and connect it to the next floor. Take the wiring up and do the same thing. But they're just slowly stacking the boxes. The concrete boxes are all really strong. They can take the weight of all those boxes stacked on top of them. And they're becoming the structure themselves, so that they're doing the structural system and the finishes and the enclosure. They're doing it all at once. They made it all prefabricated, and they bring it out and they install it all at once. And they built this whole hotel in less than 9 months, and it was ready for opening day of Hemisphere. And it's still there. It's the Hilton Palacio del Rio in San Antonio. Many of you probably know it. It's right on the Riverwalk. But there it was in 1968, a very, very innovative building process. Now, it kind of makes you wonder, why the hell don't they do that more often? I mean, why are we still building stick by stick by stick instead of some more prefabricated, more mechanized, more industrialized way of building? Why not more robotics and more, build it like a car, for God's sake, you know, in a factory with robots and high-tech, digital, blah, 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 blah. Why aren't we doing this? And if you could tell me the answer to that, I'd appreciate it, because I don't know why we're not doing this. But we are not. Those innovations come slowly, and in many ways, we build a lot the same way. I mean, I've been at this a really long time. See all this gray hair? It's not so different. I work construction every summer when I was in high school and college. I go out to a construction site now. There are a lot more OSHA rules. You have to wear your headgear more conscientiously. You have to have different kind of shoes. You have to wear these bright colored funny little vests. I mean, some of those things are different. But in terms of the way we actually build buildings, you know, it's not that different than it was when I was in college. And I don't know why, but maybe for the future, this is going to be a big change in the building industry. So that's all about the building process in general. Now, what we're going to do today is we're going to look at three buildings at different points in time and understand how does the building process affect the design of the building. How are these two things linked? And when you want to do some cool-ass thing in design, but people don't know how to build it, how do you figure that out? How do you innovate? How do you create new ways of building that will enable new possibilities in architecture? So we're going to start with a Gothic cathedral. And we could have done this for any Gothic cathedral, but we're going to look at Amiens. Amiens is a late Gothic cathedral. It's one of the last French Gothic cathedrals built. It's often called High Gothic. It's just about as Gothic as you can get. By this time, it's a very refined way of building, and they have the building process down pat. But it took a lot of innovation to get there. And we're going to talk about the innovations that Gothic architecture produced in order to get the kind of building they aspired to have. So what they wanted was the very tallest, the very lightest, the very most light-filled space they could possibly get. They were trying to reach to the heavens. They were trying to connect with God. And if you're a medieval person, that was just a kind of phenomenal, amazing spiritual thing. So that's the goal. But they're building out of stone. And we know from last time what stone structures look like. They're normally these heavy, thick-walled, solid things with just an opening in them, like an arch, to let some light in. But generally, they're very solid, heavy buildings. So what they wanted, what they aspired to, was not exactly what the construction method allowed or the material allowed. So they had to invent some new possibilities. And one of the great inventions they made was the flying buttress, that thing right there. So they wanted this tall, tall, tall space. And when you make a wall that tall, it wants to fall over like that. It, a little short wall, that's fine. It doesn't have much of lateral forces. But when you get tall like that, you have to make it super thick in order for it not to want to topple over. I mean, you just know that intuitively. The wall gets thick. It needs lots of stone to withstand any kind of lateral load that might come on it. But they didn't want it thick. They didn't want this heavy, heavy wall. So instead, they take those loads and they pull them out to these buttresses out here. And they take that load, distribute it out here, take the load here, distribute it out there, so that that wall, which is the wall on the inside, that wall, gets to be as light and as thin as it possibly can be. And this was really an incredible invention, to take those loads off of the enclosure wall and carry them out to the flying buttresses that extended out from that wall. That then allowed a lot of light to penetrate. You could have huge windows, you could have gorgeous stained glass in those windows, and the cathedral could be filled with light and filled with color and be this magnificent experience that is a Gothic cathedral. So they know what they want here. They figure out structurally how that could be accomplished. But then they had to figure out, well, how the heck do we build it? And not just how do we build those walls, but how do we make those vaults? I mean, we know how to build a vault, maybe, but that's where it's down here where we can build, right? Well, how do you build that vault way the hell up there? And how do we get all that stone up there? And, now it'd be easy. We have steel scaffolding, right? No big deal. But they don't have steel scaffolding. They've got wood. Even the pieces of wood they have in this part of France, they don't have big timbers. And they can import big timbers, but they're super expensive. So how do you manage to build this tall, way taller than anything else in your town? You got 2-3-story buildings around here. This thing is like 10 stories tall. How do you do that? And it required the Gothic builders to figure all that out. So let's walk through some of the things they did. So at the beginning, it's a piece of cake. It's easy. You build a crypt. That's the kind of basement. And then you start up from that with these. You build the foundation in the crypt. And then you begin to build these stone piers. And actually, they use a different kind of stone on the lower part here. And you can see this grayer stone. It's different from the stone up here, which is a tanner stone. And they're doing that because the lower stone gets exposed to moisture. There's moisture in the ground. And the stone, if it's not very dense stone, it will absorb that moisture. It's called the damp rising, and it actually destroys the stone over time. So they want these things to last for eons, so they get this super dense stone, the gray stone, from one quarry, and they lay it down first, anywhere at the bottom of the building where you might have moisture connected to the ground. And then after they go up a certain height, this is about 5 feet, then they go back to the much more plentiful and actually much more beautiful creamy-colored limestone that they built the rest of the cathedral out of. So they're building it stone on stone on stone. They've got some wood scaffolding. You know, they've got some reasonable-sized trees around, and they can build that scaffolding for a while. And then it gets up to a certain point, and then, you know something? The wood isn't strong enough. You can't build the scaffolding out of that wood anymore. So how do we go any higher? We can't. we can't build it any higher. No, but we want to build it higher. So they invented this interesting mechanism where they got the scaffolding to rest on the wall itself. So as they built the wall up, they would make little leave-out places in the masonry, and they would stick their wood in there and cantilever it out. And then they would make this structure that was really leaning on the wall, dependent on the wall, and that would be the scaffolding. So now you could go up as high as you wanted. It's not resting on the ground, it's resting on the wall. Well, then how do I get the stone up there to do my construction? So they actually built these little spiral stairs that would help them take up their stone and their mortar and the people and get them up to these little platforms that they were cantilevering off of the wall. And these days, all over in Gothic cathedrals, you see those little spiral stairs. So probably there's some of you who paid your, I don't know, 4 francs or something like that in the old days, or a euro now. And you go in the Gothic cathedral and you walk up these spiral stairs and you get to the top and you get a beautiful view out over the countryside. How many people have done that? Okay. So you probably thought, did you think, back in the 13th, 14th century, they were thinking, there's going to be a ton of tourists from the United States in the 21st century. And we got to have some way for them to get up and get a good picture from the top of this thing. So we're going to put all these little spiral stairs in here. Wrong. No, they never imagined any tourists would be there. Those stairs were construction stairs. They were there to take the materials and the people up to the upper parts of the building during construction. Thankfully, they're there, and we can use them to get up and see that beautiful view off the bell tower. So that was one invention to increase the height they could build the masonry up to. But what happens when you have this big old rose window here? You can't put those cantilevered structures off of that delicate, incredibly fragile rose window. So, okay, then they have to do special little structures that they would have designed, a special way to scaffold around that rose window so they could do the construction in that part, and it would rely back on the stone below it or the stones to the side of it. So, okay, we can build this thing up. We can go as high as we want, building masonry piers, one on top of another, going up the walls of the building. But then, wait, what happens when you're going to try to build the top? Number one, now we do need some big pieces of wood. And you have to go to Lebanon or to Germany or someplace like that, and they could fell the timber, great expense, bring it to France, to Amiens. And they could build these big trusses. But wait, how the hell do you get the truss up there? I mean, these days we just have a tower crane, right? They put the tower crane up, and then they lift everything on the building with the tower crane. But of course, there are no tower cranes, and there's no mechanical systems to do that sort of thing. So how do you actually hoist those pieces up? And again, they had this prefabricated idea where they would make the truss down on the ground. They would get all of these pieces just the size and the shape they needed. They would make the joints, and what they did was what's called a mortise and tenon joint, where you make a hole in one piece and you make a slot in the other piece, and they intersect like that, and then you drill a hole through and you put a wooden peg through that hole, and that makes a good tight joint. Not nails, but this mortise and tenon joint. So what they do is they prefabricate all those joints down on the ground, and then they disassemble all the pieces from each other, and then they have this elaborate machine here, which is like a treadmill. So you know, like when you have a pet gerbil and you have this little wheel? Well, this is a gerbil wheel for human beings. So a guy gets inside that thing and does like this and runs really fast, and that turns the wheel, and then that creates a pulley, and that pulls up these incredibly heavy pieces of timber one by one. And then they get up there and they align those things and they reconstruct them and they put those pegs in to the mortise and tenon joint, and they construct each truss prefabricated and then erected up at the top of the building. So that's what that process looks like in order to make those trusses. Okay, so we got the walls, we got the trusses. How about these flying buttresses? So we know that an arch shape works perfectly when it's complete, when there's a keystone in it and all of it is complete. But we also know that an arch doesn't work at all if it's not complete. So how do you put those pieces in place so that they don't fall down before they're complete? So in order to do that, you use formwork, or what was called centering, which are these wooden pieces they would make, erect like that, put the stones on top of them, and then let the stones set up. When they're completely set up, then they pull the formwork away, and that leaves the beautiful stone arch, making the flying buttress like that. And that would be true for the pointed arch openings that they would have in the building as well. But again, they had to figure all this out. They had to imagine a building process that would get the results they wanted. Okay, so how about those damn groin vaults? I mean, we're way, way, way up at the top of the cathedral, and we're trying to make this delicate-shaped piece, and it's once it's done, we know it all works. But then how do you actually make it happen piecemeal? So the first thing they did was they did ribs, so that it's just arches across like this. And they built them with centering, like we're seeing right there. So there's formwork for all of those. So now you have the ribs. But then in order to put the webs in between the ribs, what they did was simulate the loads of the vault when it's finished at every stage of incompletion. So in the end, the stones up here will be pushing down on the stones there and keep them in place. So in the meantime, you have a rope and a rock on the end of it that simulates that load and allows you to put a stone in there, simulate the load on it, put the next stone in, simulate the load on it, and continuously each stone thinks that the whole arch is complete because you've simulated the loads that would be there when it's finished. And eventually you make all the webs between those ribs using that method. Again, innovation in building process that lets them get the goal they want in terms of the design. So it took thousands, literally thousands of little inventions like this of building. How do I build? In order to make something as complex and as gorgeous and as interesting as a Gothic cathedral. Okay, completely different challenge here. So that Gothic cathedral at Amiens was done in the, I guess that one's about what? What are the dates on that? 1220 to 1406. So it's about 180 years that it took to do that. So it's a long, long building process. This is happening just a few years after they finished Amiens. They started a new cathedral in Florence. This is Santa Maria della Fiore in Florence. And the initial architect was a guy named Arnolfo di Cambio. And the initial idea in Florence was that they would build a Gothic cathedral. That's what they started out doing. Because they're in Gothic period. I mean, it's just a few years after Amiens was finished. This would have been High Gothic. 1296 is when they started. So that partly is happening because the Italians have a kind of inferiority complex at this stage to the Germans and the French. The Germans and the French are ruling the world at the time, and the Italians are kind of not very prominent. Part of what was happening in Florence and in other places in Italy, it was not a country, it was more like a series of city-states, and so they weren't very unified. And even in Florence, there were two extremely powerful families, the Guelphs and the Ghibellines. And these families had been warring against each other for generations. So instead of being affluent and a rich culture and a productive culture, they were always picking at each other and warring. And So they had not developed a very powerful presence in Europe. And the French, on the other hand, and the Germans had their shit together. And they were kind of the dominant culture. And when you get a dominant culture, that's often the culture that's inventing things in architecture. So the French in that period, in the medieval period, they were kicking ass. They were building all these beautiful Gothic cathedrals. And the Italians, well, they were kind of copying the French. That's about the best they could do. And so we have Italian Gothic cathedrals, but they're not very distinguished, and they're basically just kind of secondhand ripoffs of what the French were doing. So that's kind of what's happening here in Florence. They're building a Gothic cathedral. It's not going to be a very good Gothic cathedral. That's what it was supposed to look like. So it's got some pointed arches like good Gothic architecture is supposed to have. And it's got a big nave down the center, and it's got side aisles. The plan looks like a Gothic cathedral. But it's not going to be a very distinguished Gothic cathedral. Then a funny thing happened in the middle of the 13th century and toward the end of the 13th century. So the Guelphs and the Ghibellines made peace with each other, and they began to cooperate. And they had tremendous resources, and they were smart people. And so the economy began to flourish, and they began to get more economic success. And as they did that, they began to wonder, do we really want to build this kind of half-assed French cathedral in our city? Maybe we should be doing something that's more, shows what we can do, what we're capable of as Italians. So they could go down to Rome and they could see the Pantheon that we looked at last time. Now that was a bold, amazing building. And we did that as Italians. We did that Pantheon. So why are we now doing sort of half-assed versions of what the French are doing? Why don't we do some kick-butt cool thing like our forefathers did when they were building all these great things in Rome? So they went down there. There's a lot of archaeology being done, trying to understand those Roman structures. Some of them had been buried. They were unearthing some of those Roman structures. And so the people in Florence get the idea, you know, instead of making a Gothic cathedral, what if at the end of this building that we're building, we had a dome, like the Pantheon, a big, cool dome. So they had built these black walls already, and they were about to build the end of it, which would have been a Gothic termination. But they got this idea of the dome in their head, and they just couldn't get it out of their head. So they actually build a big model of what they thought the cathedral should look like. And it had a dome on it, and that's the model right there. It was big enough so you could walk inside and kind of look up and see what that dome would look like. So everybody in town goes in there, they look at this, you know, huge model of this thing, and they say, damn, that would be sweet. This is what we ought to do. But unfortunately, no one knew how they built the Pantheon. They knew they could, when it's finished, they know it works. You can make a stone dome like that, and it spans a big area. They knew it would work, but they didn't know how they built it, how the Romans built it. They didn't know how they built Hagia Sophia. We still don't know, really, how they built Hagia Sophia. So they're trying to figure out, how do we do this? So they've made some drawings, and you know the aspiration is there. So then in 1350, you know, they've been building this thing for about 50 years. And then wham, they have this huge, horrible disease that spreads all over in Florence. It's called the Black Death. And it killed like a third of the people in the city. So for a good 10 years, just nothing happened. Everybody was just recovering from the Black Death. But then when they did recover, they were like totally resolved, okay, we're going to build that dome. And they decided we'll have a competition, and we'll see who has the best idea for how to build a dome. So they had this big competition, and people from all over entered it.
And there was one submission that I actually think should have won. It did not win, but it was a really cool submission. And so we're going to talk about it first, and then we'll talk about the one that won. So the one that didn't win, this guy had the idea that what we do is we go in and we fill the entire cathedral with dirt. And then we build a big mound of dirt where we want the dome to be. And then we just build the dome on top of the dirt. And that would be easy. We're building it on the ground, right? And dirt is cheap, and we've got plenty of it, so we ought to be able to do that great. And then people say, well, but how would you get the dirt out of the cathedral? He says, oh, I got that figured out. So what we'll do is, as we put the dirt in, we'll put coins in occasionally. And the Florentines are also greedy. They'll figure out some way to get the dirt out of the building and get those coins. So that was his competition entry. That's cool, isn't it? I mean, that should have won. That was a great idea. But it didn't win. Instead, the winner was this guy named Filippo Brunelleschi. And Filippo Brunelleschi had actually lived in Florence all his life. And he had this idea of how to build that dome. And the way to build that dome he had was based in four different things. I thought I had a picture of Filippo in here, but he's not there. Okay, four different things he was going to do. One is number one, whereas if you saw that earlier drawing, the dome just sat right on the walls of the nave. It was right at that level. The first thing Brunelleschi said was, we're going to put a drum on top. We're going to raise that dome up higher. So they had already started to build some of these little semi-domes. And they thought at a certain time, okay, that's how we're going to, that's going to help us carry the loads of this dome, all these little semi-domes like we saw at Hagia Sophia. They also thought, well, we'll need some buttresses. And so they started building some buttresses like that. But honestly, Brunelleschi said, you know, you don't really need all that stuff. We're just going to build this drum up above all that stuff that you've already constructed and let that dome sit all by itself up there. So there's Filippo right there. And he has this idea for the tambour or drum that the whole thing sits on. Then his second idea was a little bit like those groin vaults, the divide and conquer notion on building that dome. The first thing we're going to build is eight ribs. And we'll build those with centering in the way we know how to do. But it won't have the load of the whole thing. It'll just be these eight ribs. And then in between each of those eight ribs, we'll build two smaller ribs. So it'll be a combination of 24 ribs that we'll build first. Slowly build it by stages. Build the eight ribs, then using those eight ribs, build two smaller ribs between each one and get these 24 ribs going around the dome. And he decided the eight ribs, they'd actually express them on the outside of the dome. So that was one, that was a second big idea. The drum, the eight ribs. Then the third idea was, instead of making then one web, which would have been incredibly thick and heavy, you couldn't have used those ropes and rocks because the simulated loads would have to be too big. This is a huge span. So it just wouldn't work the way they'd done it before. So he had said, instead, we'll build two smaller domes, an inside dome and an outside dome. And then we'll connect the two together. And together, they'll have the strength to do the job of the whole dome. But as we're building it, it only means building a smaller bit and a smaller bit. Again, the sort of divide and conquer idea. And if you go to the dome of Santa Maria della Fiore today, you can actually go in this space in between. It also provided space for construction so that it was safer for the workers to be in this space instead of just above that open space dangling in thin air. So it created, and there are steps and there are ways to traverse all of that space between the two domes. And then the domes are tied together, as you can see, in various places to make them act as one dome when they were all linked together. So we got the tambour, We got the 8 ribs and then the 24 ribs, and then we have the 2 different shells of the dome. And then the fourth idea was to use these chains. So when you had a stone wall like that, this big thick stone wall of the tambour, you would drill out a little valley in there, and you would put big thick iron chains in there. And that was reinforcing. So it acted like a belt. So as those forces of the dome wanted to push out, instead of having buttresses to push them in, instead he's got a chain that acts as a belt and cinches in the dome. And the chains are, of course, in tension, wanting to spread out, and the iron, later we would have used steel, was very good in tension, and that made the reinforcing work. So those 4 ideas allowed him to build this incredible dome. Now, there were lots and lots of other things. He had to figure out how to do the scaffolding. He had to figure out how to do the centering for the 8 ribs. You know, there were tons of other inventions along the line, but eventually that made a possibility for this big open domed space, and definitely did what they wanted to do. All those people building Gothic cathedrals up in France and Germany were jealous as hell of these beautiful domed cathedrals they were building down in Italy, and the Renaissance began. In fact, Brunelleschi is generally one of the 2 fathers of the Renaissance, Alberti and Brunelleschi. And they do a whole series of big domed cathedrals in Italy, culminating with St. Peter's another couple of hundred years later. So, you know, it transformed completely the way people looked at Italy. It transformed completely the sort of ascendant architectural style. But in order to do this, they had to have some technological inventions. They had to have a building process that would support these ideas. Okay, just to show this happens in all eras, not just really old buildings like Gothic cathedrals or Santa Maria della Fiore, big Renaissance cathedral. This is a building in the 20th century that had equally incredible technological challenges in terms of building process. So this one also has one of those crazy-ass stories that go with it. This is, of course, the Sydney Opera House. We looked at it in an earlier lecture, and we were admiring it for its form, its rhythm, its shape, its texture, its materials. It's an incredibly beautiful building. Iconic building on travel posters all over the world. It is an emblem for the entire continent of Australia, certainly for the city of Sydney. I don't know, years and years ago when they had the Olympics in Sydney, basically the entire TV coverage, they were always, you know, back panning shots of Sydney Opera House, Sydney Opera House, Sydney Opera House. It's the iconic emblem of Australia and of Sydney. Now, that actually was part of the intention from the beginning. When they started in 1957 to think of having a new opera house in Sydney, they decided that they didn't want just an everyday opera house where you could go to the opera and everybody enjoy themselves and go home and no big deal. Instead, they wanted to have an opera house that would be a real landmark and that would be an emblem of their country and of their city. So they decided they were going to have a big competition again. And this was a worldwide competition. There were an incredible number of entries, I think like 600 entries from all over the world. And they had a distinguished jury, a group of people who were going to judge the competition and select the winner. And they had like 8 renowned architects that were on this jury. The chair of that jury was Eero Saarinen. We know Eero Saarinen from the TWA terminal at Kennedy Airport. Last time we looked at the Morrison Stiles Colleges at Yale by Eero Saarinen. We looked at the John Deere headquarters by Eero Saarinen. In the 1950s, Eero Saarinen was probably the most important architect of his younger generation. Le Corbusier was still around, Alvar Aalto was still around. Walter Gropius, some of the older generation, but this guy was like in his 40s. And he was a real up-and-coming architect. And so he was the chair of this jury. So we got to think back in 1957, it's no small thing to actually go to Sydney. So they're making all these jurors go from Europe and from the United States and from all over the world, and they're convening in Sydney. So Errol Saarinen had a flight to Sydney. This is still in a period when there's not a whole lot of transcontinental flights going on, and his flight is late. And it's not that it's like a few hours late. You know, there's like one flight a week from the United States to Australia. So he missed that flight, doesn't go, and so he's really late, like several days late getting to the jury. Everybody else got there fine, but the chair of the jury, Errol Saarinen, he's really late. So all these guys that are there, they think, okay, let's not waste our time here. We'll just start going through all these hundreds of entries, and we'll call out the best ones and put all the losers aside. And then when Arrow gets here, then we'll have, I don't know, 50 of the best ones, and we'll work from there. So that was the process they went through. So Errol Saarinen arrives late, and they show him the 50 or so that they had selected, and he looks through them, and he says, this one's shit, this one's shit, this one's shit, this one's not good enough, that's too timid. This is not innovative enough. This is not going to be iconic. This is not going to be an emblem of a continent. This one's not good enough. This one's, you know, and he went through all 50 of them and he didn't find a single one that he liked. So he said, okay, I want to go back to the bone pile, the ones you guys threw away. So he goes and starts rifling through all of these that they threw away. And in the rejects, he finds this one competition entry that's basically all it was. Part of the reason they'd thrown it out is because it didn't have enough drawings to qualify. They had certain required drawings and required numbers, and it didn't fulfill the requirements. So they threw it out. But Errol Saarinen pulled this one out and he said, damn, that's cool. This kid's got balls, you know. There's something going on this one. But that's all there was just this kind of plan and just a few little sketches, very meager representation of this building. Turns out it was submitted by this really young architect, Jorn Utzon, who really green, and he's in Denmark. His father had been a boat builder, and so he's kind of thinking of these boat-like shapes. It's in the water in the harbor of Sydney. There's this big harbor bridge that has that same kind of graceful. So he's taking those shapes of the bridge and of sailboats and of the hulls of boats, and he's thinking of this opera house inspired by those things, and he's got these incredible aspirations for this thing. And so Errol Saarinen pulls it out of the bone pile, takes it up to the other jurors. They're like, you got to be kidding. This is amateur hour. You know, this will never fly. They'll think this is a joke. You know, we'll all be run out of town. We got to get a more serious project. And he said, no, no, no. It's cool. It's really cool. You know, this is going to be great. And he was a silver-toned bastard. I mean, this guy could convince. And pretty soon, one by one, he convinces these jurors. And so they agree on this entry winning the competition. The thing appeared on the front page of the Sydney newspaper, and people just guffawed. It was just like, that's not a building. You know, they just couldn't understand it at all. The budget for the thing was $3 million, which in 1957 seemed like an adequate amount of money. In the end, this building cost $108 million. It wasn't a little over budget. It was astronomically over budget. But that wasn't the worst of it. I mean, look at the dates on this. So the dates are 1957 to 1973. That's 16 years. What building in the 20th century takes 16 years to build? You're supposed to be able to build a long construction is 2 years, 2.5 years. 16 years to build this building. There were so many problems. There were so many things that didn't work, that had to be solved, that were questions that were just stumped everybody, because it had to reinvent a building process because it was such an unusual building. So Jörn Utzon thought that he would build it out of thin shell concrete. So Eero Saarinen also thought it would be built out of thin shell concrete. He had done a few, you know, think of the TWA building. That's got those curvy forms too. They're much smaller, much, much, much smaller than this. But he thought, you know, we could do this in thin shell concrete, which would be pretty efficient. But it turns out those shapes that he had right there, they don't work in thin shell concrete. They're not good structural shapes. So there were extremely erratic loads in all the wrong places. And so the concrete was getting super thick, like 3 or 4 feet thick. And then when it gets up there like that, it's so heavy. So it's requiring even more structure because the concrete itself is so heavy. And it just was a nightmare. So they actually brought in the best engineer in the world, a guy named Ove Arup in London, brought him into the project. We got this green, you know, skinny young architect from Denmark. He's like about 6'6 and about, I don't know, 200 pounds, skinny ass guy. And he's down there among all these Australians and trying to get his building built, and they're like, "You're nuts, you're nuts," you know. And they bring in this big badass engineer, and this is just the very beginning of using computers to do calculations. So because it's such a complex structure, they've got this big, you know, a computer the size of a Winnebago that is working on, you know, trying to crunch through the numbers on this thing. And it's just, it's causing big nightmares. So it was not just the shape that was screwy about it, but also just the scale. It's so big. And how do we get all that concrete up that high? And, you know, of course you could build formwork out of steel, but then it's like you built the entire building out of steel and then you pour concrete on top of it and then you destruct the steel building. That was like inconceivable. It was just too much effort and work. They thought about doing it precast so that they take all the little pieces and they add them up there. But every, in his original design, every single piece would have been different because the curvature was not uniform on those. It changed curvature as it went through the sails. So it was very frustrating to everybody. The political heat was really heavy. The government was building this thing, and they needed to see some progress. So they insisted they go ahead and pour the foundation. So they started pouring the foundation. It's in the freaking harbor, so you know you're pouring a foundation in the water. So it's very, very complicated foundation. They pour this foundation, but they still don't know how they're going to build the top. They still don't even know where all the loads are going to be on the top. So it's kind of crazy to build the foundation without knowing all that. So in the midst of all this confusion, one morning, Jörn Utzon is having a grapefruit for breakfast. And as he cuts his grapefruit, he realizes that he could cut the sphere of the grapefruit in these little segments that made sails that were almost like the shapes that he had in his sketches. Not exactly. They had uniform curvature. His sketches did not have uniform curvature. But he thought, if I could get close to the same idea with all of the curvature being the same, then we could precast all of those pieces using the same formwork. And that would make it repetitive and make it much easier. So he goes back to the engineers and he shows them these new ideas. And in fact, that did begin to make the loads much more uniform. And it began also to make a way of actually precasting those pieces and then erecting them with a crane and putting the thing into place. Now, it still was a very, very complicated process. And one thing about Jörn Utzon, I mean, he grows 16 years worth of gray hair in the period that he's designing this, and he gets to be a much more knowledgeable architect as he goes along, but he also gets to be a more ambitious architect. So at every point, he had bigger ambitions for the building. So it didn't stop being complicated. It got complicated over and over and over again. At one point, for example, he had this beautiful lobby that overlooks the whole harbor, and he wanted everything made out of glass, no steel. None of that steel there. It comes out like this and goes back, and it would all be made of structural glass. Glass has structural properties, but it's not very capable structurally. But he had the idea that we can make it all out of structural glass, and it'll just be totally transparent, and you'll be able to see the entire harbor without any distractions. No mullions, no steel, no nothing, just glass. The glass would have, they did the engineering, it was possible. The glass would have been 2 feet thick in some places to make it structural glass that would do that. And he was like, yeah, of course, we've got to do this. And at a certain point, the Australians just said, we're done with you, Jørn Utzon. We're through with you, off the job, forget it. We just got to get this building built. And so they fired him. And he was sent back to Denmark, and he did not finish the building, and in fact, he never saw the building complete until 40, 45 years later, when they called him back and asked him to do some renovations to the building, and he went back and visited this building for the first time 40 years later. But he left in a huff, and in the end, other people came up with the ideas for these steel cantilevered pieces, and then it is glass below, but you see those distracting steel members above. He did many of the details all the way through the building, but there were many of the things on the interior in particular that were not Jørn Utzon. In fact, most of the interior finishes of the performance halls and so on were designed by other people because he'd been thrown off the job by then. Now, the amazing thing about it is that, yes, it caused incredible turmoil. It's almost like, this was like putting a man on the moon. It was a constantly new challenge, another innovation. And many of those innovations actually paid off later because they were applied to many other projects. And in fact, people feel like the construction industry in Australia benefited enormously from a big boost that the Sydney Opera House produced because it made people more sophisticated in terms of how they solved construction problems. But it wasn't an easy process. Okay, Twitter card question for today. So this one's going to be a little bit of a tough one. But I'm really interested in you figuring out, in your own experience, how have these things shaped buildings that you know. So I want you to think of maybe some project you've seen where you've observed how it was built, and how it was built had something to do with what made it interesting or good. Or maybe it's an experience you had watching something being built, something in your hometown, or and some observation you could make about the relevancy of the making process to what eventually ended up being there. I realize that's a hard one. Maybe you've never really thought much about this, but rifle through your brain. What is an example of some building or some place you've experienced that it's pretty clear that was influenced by construction process?